KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Cartoonist Brian Fee started drawing the story of his family's evacuation from the Tubbs Fire just one day after his Santa Rosa home burned down. And KQED turned that comic into an animated video that got more than 2 million views and won a regional Emmy Award. Now Brian Fee has released a graphic novel, a fire story which follows his family and others affected by the 2017 California wildfires. And we'll talk with him about the book, the response he's received in the community, and his process of rebuilding. It's all next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Cartoonist Brian Fee's graphic novel begins on Monday, My House Disappeared. Fee's Santa Rosa house was one of 6,200 homes destroyed in the wildfires that tore through Northern California in October of 2017. The day after his house burned, Fee started drawing about his experience. His graphic memoir, A Fire Story, tells the story of his family and others affected by the 2017 California wildfires. And welcome, Brian Fee.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.
Grateful to have you here, and grateful that you have come through this and done this book, which I think is a very important book, and I want to drill down on it and also let people know the experience you went through. And we're listened to on Sirius, too, and I know sometimes people think, well, this is a wildfire that just affected Northern California, but we're talking about something that affects thousands of people, these kinds of disasters, whether they're fires or hurricanes or tornadoes. And unfortunately, disasters has been a ticket for you to get a good deal of attention for your fine work. I'm talking about last time you were on Forum was 2006, and you had written a memoir about your mother's cancer.
Well, unfortunately, that's true. I seem to have a knack for, telling these kinds of stories in which something awful happens to me or my family or my loved ones, and I find interesting things to talk about.
Well, you do a very good job. The book was had quite an impact, I think, on many people, and that's evidence of the fact that it went viral, and the animated version of it had about, 3 million viewers, I think?
Yes, yes.
So let's talk about it, and talk about it beginning with the fact that when the fire began, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and your wife thought she smelled smoke, and you assumed that it was maybe the Calistoga fire, which was going on farther north, and the fact of the matter is, disbelief is really the, I mean, you get take us through a whole gamut of emotions, but disbelief is really the prominent and most initial thing that you have to experience.
And almost universal, I think. One of the interesting things I've learned after talking, after the fire, after talking to many people who went through it is almost everybody who evacuated the night thought they'd be gone for 2 days, unless their house was actively on fire when they left it. Everybody said, I'll be back in 2 days. And so did I. I packed 2 pairs of socks, 2 pair of underwear. You know, you can handle 2 days. 2 days is a weekend in a hotel. That's not a problem. Not one of us thought we'd come back to our houses being completely destroyed. I find that interesting psychologically. I don't know if that's a defense mechanism we have.
Maybe you're just used to going away for a weekend or something.
Well, I think that's part of it is because houses and trees and neighborhoods, they're so permanent. You know, you just can't imagine them disappearing in the matter of 3 or 4 hours like ours did. When I walked back in the next morning after the fire, although I'd lived in the neighborhood 17 years, I had to follow street signs because all of the other landmarks were gone. I couldn't find my way back to my own house.
It also discovered, I think, and by the way, this is not only your story, but you bring in other people's stories in the course of this graphic memoir you've done. There's also a universal sense that you came across that people think, well, because 44 people died in this fire, that I had it pretty bad, but not necessarily as bad as not only people who experienced death, but other people had it maybe more difficult and more tragic than I had.
Well, I was stunned by that, actually. Almost everyone I talked to, again, said, as you just said, they knew people who had it worse. And these are people who might have lived in a mobile home and had no insurance and left in the middle of the night with nothing. They had literally nothing. And almost to a person, they said, I know someone who's got it worse than I do. And I think part of that is a reluctance to accept charity. I think nobody wants to be pitied. And so they just try to deflect it on someone else. You know, don't give me that pair of shoes. Give it to my friend who doesn't have any. And my wife and I certainly count ourselves among the lucky ones. We had 15 minutes to pack. We had insurance. We had some money in the bank. You know, compared to so many people, not just in Sonoma County and Napa County, but up in especially Chico, Paradise, fires up in Washington, British Columbia, we were fortunate.
It's also fascinating to realize what people feel they need to take, you know, if they don't haven't necessarily prepared for it. And you take us there. And, for example, a couple of things that were dear to your children when they were little, you have twin daughters, were things that you grabbed, and they were so happy to see them. Then when you saw your daughters and gave them these, it was the first time you cried.
Yeah.
And they said, at that point, there were many more times that you would cry, of course, but just having to deal with so much loss. In fact, I think you say it very well in the course of your memoir. You say it's like a stab to the heart almost daily because you think about all these things that were your life, that made up your life, all these possessions, not only stuff, you know, you use that word, but it's what defines you. And suddenly you're thinking about, you even have a list of things that you realize you lost in the fires that you had to kind of catalog.
Yeah. Well, and still, a whole year and a half after the fire, hardly a week goes by that my wife and I don't look at each other and just say, oh, you know what we lost? You know what we forgot to grab? And each one of them is just a new, fresh wound. But people do say it's just stuff, and they mean well when they say that, but it's a fairly cruel and thoughtless thing to say. Stuff isn't just stuff. Stuff, as I say in the book, it's memories, it's life experience,
it's your history.
Yeah, it's your history. It's things from my ancestors I wanted my descendants to have, things that my grandparents entrusted to me thinking I'd take care of them. And I actually feel quite an acute sense of having let them down. You know, that continuity of our family, the material things handed down.
It's irrational to feel that way, but I understand that.
Yeah, I fumbled the ball.
Well, you didn't fumble the ball because the fire was something, like you said, it was an equal opportunity annihilator. And in fact, your language is really very striking. You say, the fire murdered my house, and it murdered many people as well as your house. But there's one moment, for example, where what you call emotional tripwires, your wife, Karen, who, by the way, was very much involved in this whole tragedy because she was in charge of emergency services, right?
Yes. My wife is the director of our human services department, so basically social services. And so the night of the fire, we went to her office so that she could get to work. She had to start activating phone trees, setting up shelters in high school gyms, evacuating a children's home. And it was very chaotic and improvisational because, first of all, most of her staff didn't even know there'd been a disaster. It was the middle of the night. People don't sleep with their phones on. And so transportation was down. You couldn't get up or down Highway 101, which runs through the middle of Sonoma County. And so, for example, if she had a worker in Petaluma who would normally work in Santa Rosa, 20 miles north, they couldn't get Santa Rosa. She'd tell that worker, all right, go to Petaluma High School, set up a shelter there. That wasn't that person's job. So these people are doing all these jobs they're not trained for all over the county in places they're not familiar with. It was really impressive to watch. My wife, in my opinion, was a hero that night, particularly after she discovered her own house had been destroyed, and she had to keep helping others whose homes were destroyed as well.
Well, as you point out in your book, there were a lot of heroes there, and there were a lot of mistakes made in terms of phone alerts and those kinds of things, which you go into as well. You should have been notified. You weren't. All of those things that are of concern that have come up, certainly in our discussions of the devastation and the effects and the impact of the fire. But I'll go back to those emotional tripwires that suddenly your wife said, oh, I forgot to videotape our daughters and get them digitalized, those videotapes digitalized. And there's just a good example of something. Or you're sitting and trying to work your computer and you realize that the backup isn't there. And suddenly you become a great believer in the cloud, you're a convert to the cloud and all. But these things that you don't necessarily think about on a quotidian day-to-day level because they don't necessarily enter your cranium, you know?
Right. Well, and the story about my wife and the videotapes I think is especially affecting because it was a surprise. We were just at lunch talking with a friend who said, I'm going to miss my old home movies the most. And actually, it was my responsibility and fault that we never quite got around to digitizing our videotapes. And we had 20 years of videotapes of our children's lives that just went up in smoke with no backups and no recourse. And I looked across the table at Karen, and she'd begun to cry. And I said, what's wrong? She said, I hadn't thought of that one yet. She hadn't remembered that we'd lost the videotapes.
Yeah, there are really poignant moments like that throughout your book, and moments that are elevating. I mean, particularly the way community works and the way people help each other and the kindness of strangers and all of that. But then there's also the other side, and you don't shy away from that. There are, for example, a famous local writer who I won't name once told me that the press was much too concerned about looting that wasn't really necessarily going on, she felt. But there was looting going on, and you write about the looting that went on. And you also write about something else that I think needs to be taken into consideration by people in talking about these kinds of tragedies, and that is your own feelings of anger. And I don't mean anger when you go and you see your burned-out house and you keep saying the F word over and over again. I'm talking about anger where you're sitting and you're trying to enjoy a day and you see these people going through a normal life, and suddenly it's a very kind of Schadenfreude moment where you feel anger that they're enjoying life and you have all this weight on your shoulders.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I had been told that the thing, a helpful thing to do is to try to establish your old routines, try to find something normal and ordinary you used to like to do and do that to try to get back to normal life. And so one of the things I used to like to do was take a little picnic lunch to a park nearby and just sit there and eat my lunch. And I was sitting there and watching these people play with their kids and walk their dogs, and I was just getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And I realized, how dare those people have a normal, nice life when I'm sitting here with everything in my life destroyed, you know? I just got mad at them for no rational reason, but...
But what a human thing to admit and to fess up to. I mean, because a lot of people would feel the way you did.
Well, I think the trick of writing a book like this, doing anything like this, is being honest about it and being honest about these things that don't even necessarily make you look good, just because it's true. And the true things are the ones that the readers respond to most and best.
Can you also talk about that moment when you actually found yourself laughing hysterically with somebody? He was talking about the drug house that was behind his house.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I was in line to receive a check from one government agency or another, and happened upon a neighbor whom I hadn't seen since the fire. So this is probably 3 or 4 weeks after the fire. And so we have a, you know, hearty backslapping reunion, and he tells me that his favorite story about how he'd had a drug house behind his that he'd been trying to get rid of for years. He'd called the sheriff. He'd called the local board of supervisors. He called everybody he could, and nobody could ever get rid of this drug house until October 9th, 2017, when it burned to the ground along with my friend's house. And so he told me the story about meeting the sheriff and telling him, hey, thanks for getting rid of that drug house behind mine, but did you have to burn down half the county to do it? And we just had a good laugh about that and then just realized how deeply unfunny that was. But
you capture the expressions. I mean, as the animator, as a cartoonist, I mean, first there's all this laughter in their in both of your faces, and then there's the serious recognition.
Yeah, just that moment afterwards when the laugh ends and you're just looking at each other like, oh, we both lost our homes, and you know, that's not funny.
Brian Fees here with us in studio, cartoonist and author of A Fire Story, and I'm going to open the phone lines now. Some of you may want to share your experiences in the fires or how you cope with other disasters. We'll open up the phone lines and invite you to be part of the program, and you can do that now by calling in toll-free. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Let me repeat the number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, post any questions or comments you have there at kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page. You really cover broad territory here, Brian. I mean, you're getting into not only all this emotional reaction and going through the tragedy and actually sorting it all through and processing it, which you're still doing, I presume.
Yes.
But also, you know, going and dealing with seeing your home actually burn. I mean, at first you couldn't get through there. Once you get through and you see that, like I said, it's just the expletives that that come out, understandably. But there's FEMA, and there you are thinking, what do we do about developing and rebuilding and all those big questions that loom over the whole subdivision and all these areas that have burned out and so forth. And that's also a big emotional mountain to climb.
Oh, it's immense. Again, as I describe in the book, you know, my wife and I are both very smart people, but we've never built a house before. We've never worked with an architect or a designer or even taken out a building permit. And all of a sudden, we had to master all of these very, you know, these very arcane disciplines. and very much had to rely on the kindness of strangers. It's when you realize how valuable it is to have a friend who's a soils engineer or a daughter who's an archaeologist who knows how to dig stuff up. You know, those skills, which, you know, the day before meant nothing, all of a sudden are the most important skills you can draw upon.
And the big question in your mind was, who can we trust here, right?
I mean, very much so, yeah. I mean, we've had friends we've known for 30 years who were in the trades or whatever, and of course we turn to them for advice. But you know, even well-meaning people give you conflicting advice. And at the same time, you're dealing with a disaster, you're dealing with cleanup, and you're dealing with the idea that the effect of this disaster on an economy, when say 10, 20,000 people lost their homes and another 10,000 or 5,000 lost their jobs, and the price of everything, not everything, the price of building supplies, of concrete, lumber, labor instantly doubles or triples. You're looking at insurance not being able to pay enough to rebuild, all of these things. The learning curve was just a steep cliff that we navigated as best we could with the help of people we could trust. And we made the best decisions we could at the time, you know, and we lived with them, and we realized we wouldn't know if they were the right decisions for another year or two.
Well, we're talking about an experience in one way or another hundreds of thousands of people have shared in some form or another. Does that give you any comfort? Or let me ask it another way. Was it cathartic and comforting to some extent to write this book?
Cathartic is a word. Therapeutic is another word people ask. I think those are two different concepts. I think there's therapeutic value in writing it because in order to write, you've got to understand what happened. You've got to analyze it. You've got to do some research. And I really wanted the graphic novel version of A Fire Story to stand as a piece of journalism. I want it to be well-researched, as comprehensive a story of this fire as a 160-page comic book could be.
Should mention you're an ex-reporter, so you had that advantage too.
Yeah, and it really felt like doing journalism for me. I felt that gene kick in. Therapeutic in the sense of you have to think about it, you have to analyze it, you have to understand why you feel what you feel and ask those questions and record them. That's fine. I really push back a little bit about the idea of catharsis because catharsis sort of implies getting it off your chest, putting it behind you, unloading yourself. And I don't think that happens. I don't think it happens when you're writing a book about a thing, because when you write a book, you're immersed in that subject for a year. You have to stay in that headspace of having just lost your home. You have to be able to tap those emotions for a long time. And even now, I'm so grateful to be here, but now I'm doing a radio talk show about losing my home, you know, a year and a half later. I'm not sure that's healthy. But it's the job.
Well, if the word catharsis makes you somewhat uncomfortable, I've got one that I think makes you even more uncomfortable from reading your book. People want to, I'm just reading from the book here, people seem to want a story with uplift and closure, but I have no uplift to give, and anyone who says closure around me may get a punch in the nose.
Yeah, there's no closure. I don't think there's any such thing. I think you just, a scab gradually grows over that wound, and you just carry on with your new life as best you can. But no, there's no closure. There's no putting this behind you. My life will forever be divided into my life before the fire and my life after the fire, long as I live.
That binary comes across very strongly. It's like this is a new life, and new life is something almost connotatively we associate with. I mean, there is blooming eventually. There is, you know, the new house that you're building and all of that mountain to climb, as I said. But nevertheless, there's a sense that you're taking us along this journey and you're saying that whole life before me has just in so many ways been erased.
Yeah.
Gone.
Very much so.
Up and smoke.
Literally.
Yeah. And to sort through all that and to really, you know, experience that again and everything, I mean, my hat goes off to you just for having lived it again, because that's what you do when you write a memoir like this. How about writing a memoir, though, with the cartoons? I mean, I was telling you before we went on the air that I had a whole lesson in graphic novels when I did a textbook because I wanted to include graphic fiction and so forth, but I didn't know a lot about them, and now they're a whole open up. They're like podcasts, you know, they become an enormous industry unto themselves. But you could have written this another way. You could have used your reporter skills and just done it as strict journalism. Why the cartoons?
Well, you mentioned my first book, Mom's Cancer, and I told my mother's story of her diagnosis, treatment for cancer, also in the form of comics, because one day I took her to chemotherapy, and she sat in the chair and got the chemotherapy, and it takes a couple hours. It's long and boring. So I takes the paperwork. I turned a sheet of paper over, and I drew a sketch of her sitting in the chair. And around the sketch, I put words of the drugs she was taking and the therapy regimen she was on. But I also made notes about the strawberry milkshake she was drinking and the little electronic game she was playing in her lap. And I realized that in that one picture, a cartoon, I'd captured more about what that experience was like than I could have said in 2,000 or 3,000 words of prose. So that's when I decided to tell Mom's Cancer as a comic. And so the idea of handling a very serious nonfiction traumatic topic in the form of comics was actually not new to me when my house burned down. I knew this was how I was going to tell the story. And I think the comics form is very powerful. When a comic's really working right, it's like a direct tap from the writer's brain to the reader's mind and heart, because the reader absorbs the information, processes the visual image before they even know they've analyzed it. You don't have to read the words. I make a metaphor in the book about the fire being the black hole around which we all revolve afterwards. And some people get sucked into the black hole and are lost to despair and divorce, and even there were some suicides. And other people get flung out of the gravitational field of the black hole into other states, and we never see them again. And the rest of us just kind of circle this black hole uneasily, trying not to get sucked in, navigating this weird space as best we can. Now, you know, I just said that in words. If I tried to write it in a book, I might need 500 words to describe that. I drew one picture. Right, I drew one picture, and the reader opens it to that page and gets it. They say, "I understand what's going on in that metaphor." So comics excel at metaphor and symbolism.
You get a whole sense of swirling, of a kind of cosmic swirling in that particular metaphor, the way you use it and animate it.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. But
you're being philosophical at the same time that you're really trying to visualize what you're conveying philosophically, which is, you know, for any writer, a pretty strong burden to carry.
I appreciate that. I work at that.
Well, it shows. We're talking again with Brian Fees. And by the way, he'll be at Reader's Books in Sonoma on April 5th at 6:30. And he'll be at Moe's Books in Berkeley April 10th at 7 o'clock. But he's here with us now. And I'd really like to hear from listeners, not only up in Santa Rosa, but if you've been through a tragedy of any kind like this with respect to loss, what do you do to dig in and dig out? I mean, those are really the big questions that certainly concern me and I think many of our listeners. What to do, what to take, how to deal with the loss, and particularly with what Brian so nicely describes and unfortunately evokes in so passionate a way as the sense of loss, the overwhelming sense of loss. How do you deal with it? And what can you do, really? I know we can have some perhaps good and I hope wise advice from other listeners, but I do want to hear stories as well. Those of you who have been through this kind of tragedy and been through this kind of hell and how you get out on the other side, and maybe some not only advice and wisdom and tips and all of that, but some of your own stories melded into this. I mean, when I think about this Brian story, I realize that there are many, many more stories, and so does he, because he's included them in his memoir, Other People's Stories. Selected them. Maybe we can talk a bit about that. But in the meantime, we invite your involvement in the program. Toll-free number is yours. It's 866-733-6786. Join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Brian Fees, who's here with us in studio after he lost his home. He and his wife lost their home in the Northern California wildfires. He went to work and has shared the experiences not only of his family in a fire story, a graphic memoir, I call it. I think that's preferable to a graphic novel, isn't it, Brian?
I like both.
Okay, well, both will work, I guess. And we are getting some responses, as I expected, some people who want to tell their stories. Let me just read a few of these. Suzanne tweets, "Both my sister and I lost our homes. We laughed till we cried about the fact that we didn't have to sort through our parents' things. They were semi-hoarders. This was one day after the fires, we are both rebuilding and definitely on a new learning curve." Another listener says, my brother lost his home in the Paradise fires and he can't decide if he should move or rebuild. Wondering if Brian and neighbors decided to rebuild or move and if that decision has changed in the year waiting for construction or now living in new home. Most of the people in your neighborhood have rebuilt, haven't they?
Yeah, uniquely, I think. One reason we, Karen and I, decided to rebuild our home with actually very little debate was all of our neighbors said they wanted to come back as well. And we loved our neighbors. We loved our neighborhoods. So on our little street of 10 or 11 houses, I think nine, something like that, intend to come back. That's a very powerful incentive. But the cost of rebuilding is very daunting. Many people just can't afford it. They left for Sacramento or other places where their money would travel a little farther. And no hard feelings. I certainly understand that. Many neighborhoods in Sonoma County just evaporated.
Just gone.
Yeah. Everybody just went their own ways and they'll never be together again. So our little neighborhood is sticking together more or less. There's a larger neighborhood up there called Coffee Park that's had a very strong, cohesive kind of social network building, team building thing going on. I think a lot of those folks are coming back. But, it's just an individual decision and unfortunately, largely probably based on money. A lot of people just cannot afford to rebuild.
Well, you mentioned Coffee Park and the rebuilding there. We've covered that. And here's a listener who says, my husband grew up in Coffee Park and his childhood home was lost in the fire. When we visited the neighborhood last year, he too had trouble finding his way. It was a huge shock to see this place where he grew up just gone. We live in Napa and feel very lucky to have had experience much less impact. We left town for 2 weeks because the air was so unhealthy, but we're very sorry to the guest and all the others who lost so much more than a couple of weeks off work. What's the response been? Like I say, you had millions of people seeing the animated version of this, but you've gotten a lot of personal responses, obviously. You've got some personal stories as well as your own in here.
Yeah. Well, I posted a web version, an 18-page web comic, in the days immediately after the fire. And the reaction to that was immediate, and I got two sorts of reactions that were the most gratifying. One was from people who'd been through the fire with us. They'd either lost their homes or had to evacuate, or people don't remember that the fire wasn't over in a night. It lasted 2 weeks where people just were uncertain and had the car packed ready to go. Those people told me that I'd gotten it right. That meant a lot to me. The other reaction I got that was very gratifying was for people who weren't here with us, people on the other side of the country or even on the other side of the world, who said that they'd seen our fire on the news. They'd seen the mushroom cloud rising over Sonoma County as this thing tore through and made its own weather front. But that my story was the first thing they'd seen that made them understand or feel what it was like to be there. That's why I did it.
For a writer, that's about as good as it gets, isn't it?
It really is. That means I did something. I accomplished what I wanted to.
Carla writes, I've kept your initial fire story on my phone telling people about it because it gave me such a visceral and empathic reaction to what you and your neighbors lost. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences in your book. I will get a copy ASAP. And we'll get to your calls ASAP. And reminder that you can join us live at 866-733-6786. Here's Anna. Anna, join us.
Hi. Yes, I own Elusive Comics and Games in Santa Clara. Brian, I was honored to carry mom's cancer. But Michael, I must chide you for denigrating the medium of comics. This is a billion-dollar industry, a fantastic way for artists and writers to illuminate not just fictional stories, but of course stories like Brian's.
Wait, who's denigrating?
Oh, by saying that they're cartoons. You make it sound like it's something for children or something from just the Sunday papers.
No. I think you're mishearing me. I have a lot of respect for many of the people who work in graphic novels. And I think if I didn't make that point, let me make it emphatically. I learned a lot about it. And what I learned taught me that there's some really great work being done and some very impressive work being done.
There is. I fear so many people don't realize that comics are still an important medium being published every single week.
Anna, we're getting a beep there for some reason, but I grew up on classic comics. I mean, they had a big effect on me as a young man. And the fact of the matter is that now, you could read Proust in graphic form. You can read just about anybody, and it can have a whole different effect on you.
Yeah, and I appreciate the thought. I've got to say, Michael and I spoke briefly before we began our program here, and he's He's not an enemy of comics.
I've become a fan, in fact. I don't know why she got denigration, but
no. But I would say
people
just
hear
a things
differently. Yeah.
I would say I'm not overly precious about comics. I sort of embrace comics history as a vulgar art in the terms of, you know, meaning an art of the people. I think that's wonderful. I think
so
that's
was Shakespeare.
One of its good things. Shakespeare was vulgar, of one of the vulgar arts. I also think it's interesting, this is tangential, but that so many of the most popular graphic novels, Your Mouse, Persepolis, Fun Home, there are these memoirs like mine. And I think that's because there's something about this medium that lends itself to that. There's something about the medium of comics that works the same way human memory works. You know, comics are abstractions of reality. They're impressionistic. You can take a photograph that shows you exactly what a place looked like, but a comic can tell you what it felt like to be in that place. And I think that's
well said.
Yeah.
And we featured some of those graphic novels. In fact, I think when you talk about memoirs and comics, right away somebody like Art Spiegelman comes to mind. I mean, you know, some pretty serious artists who can't in any way be denigrated on any score. Let me get some more calls in here. And let's go next to Santa Rosa. Tom, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Tom. You're on.
Oh yeah. So I lived in an apartment just west of the 101 freeway, and about 1:30 in the morning, a neighbor pounded on my door, and I just grabbed my safety deposit box and ran out of my apartment. And that apartment was $1,100 a month before the fire. And about a week ago, they called me and wanted to know if I wanted to move back in one of the 40 apartments that survived. And they wanted $1,850 a month now for that apartment.
Yeah.
So, and then the caller, the comment about feeling guilty about taking help. I had a lot of offers for help, and I always felt very guilty because I've been very fortunate. But I did go to the Red Cross because there were some scammers that were filing false claims. So I wanted to make sure that they didn't scam me. And that was the only reason I went for help. But I felt really bad taking help because I have been so fortunate in my life.
That's a hard hurdle to get over. It was hard for Karen and I, too, to be willing to accept other people's help and to realize that you need to accept other people's help. You know, I really, if anything's stuck with me after this whole thing, it's the old, the very old truth that no man is an island. We relied very much on our community to get us through this, and we continue to.
And community, and let me thank you, Tom, for sharing your experiences, comes across here as very central to what you can salvage and what the vestiges are that at least create some sense of hope. Yeah.
Oh, very much so. Sure. Trying to think of good examples, but just people were so generous. People were so kind. People gave us free lunches. I went to a big box hardware store to buy a wheelbarrow, and when the woman found out that, you know, we'd lost our home, she gave me a better wheelbarrow at the same price. And just 100 little things like that, that all added up to this feeling of, you know, 100 hands kind of holding you up, that that just meant the world to us.
Best and the worst of people in these kind of disasters.
Very
and
much
tragedies.
So.
Yeah. Let me bring some more callers in. I know that may sound like a cliche to many, but it's some cliches are true. Here's Peter from Sonoma. Peter, hi.
Hi. So we lost our house when the fire came through the fourth time. And I had taken a six-month leave of absence from my job, and I put $100,000 in cash to buy materials. And I raised and leveled the house, completely rebuilt it. And 3 weeks after I finished, the fires came through and burned it down and the studio down.
Mm. Oh, jeez.
So
how you, Peter, how are you coping with that?
It's rough. It's, I want to jump back in, but it's too traumatic for my partner to approach it again. So we're just still trying to sort out what to do. But something that one of the mantras that I've told myself over the years, with, especially with this kind of a traumatic experience, is, you know, I have two choices in life. I can look back and dwell in that, or I can look forward and into what opportunities are out there, and that gives me a more positive outlook on my future and my current situation.
So, I think there's a great deal of wisdom in what you just said. In fact, go back to Brian Fee's book. I mean, you talk about the necessity of moving forward, and sometimes it's very difficult.
Well, you just have no choice. But I actually want to talk about something you mentioned, which is this trauma. You know, I talked earlier about many people not moving back just because of finances, but many people are not moving back because it's so traumatic to think about moving back to the same place. They're terrified. They've got PTSD. They don't want to be risk being burned again, even though there's no fuel left. There won't be another fire like that in that spot for 30 years because it'll take that long for the trees to regrow. But they just can't face those places again. And also up in Sonoma County, particularly back in the hills where some of these places were, you know, they were beautiful. They had I know people who had 50 oak trees on their property. Well, the oak trees are gone. So why do they want to go back? They were there. They moved there because they loved the oak trees. So for some of those people, there's just nothing worth going back to, and they'll move on and find some other nice place to live.
Again, our guest is Brian Fees, and he's the author of A Fire Story. And let me thank you for the call, Peter, and wish you the best. Jane writes, Brian mentioned that the loss of a home is more than just stuff. However, we all experience the loss differently. For me, I have felt like a freak because I seem to have accepted the losses as stuff, and I'm on a path where I'm more attuned to nature. The morning after the fire, I remember visiting the burned lot only to hear a mockingbird sing in October on top of a burned tree. Since then, I found peace at Helen Putnam Regional Park, and I've been reading books with a natural theme like Lab Girl and The Overstory.
Well, she's a little wiser than I am. I'm probably a better balance, but she's absolutely right. And in fact, I talk in the book about going back to our property and seeing naked ladies, the belladonna plants coming up, pushing up. Bulbs came through the fire. So these belladonnas, these naked ladies came up, and I transplanted them. I dug them up, put them in pots, and they're in our backyard now waiting to be replanted in our new, our rebuilt home. Daffodils came up. And in fact, the very last page in the book is a drawing of daffodils poking through the soil. And I never, ever tell anybody how to interpret my work. That's up to them. But if somebody wanted to see that drawing of daffodils as some kind of symbolism of, you know, life from death or renewal or, you know, some small positive thing to come out of this big disaster, I would not discourage that interpretation.
I'm reminded of one of my favorite novels. Novelist has always been Saul Bellow, and he ends one of his novels with the crocuses coming up, and there it is. Jordan says, I understand being upset with people enjoying their lives after the suffering you experienced. As an ecologist facing current extinctions and habitat destruction, I feel this every day. Do you have suggestions for addressing this anger and sadness?
No. Maybe see a therapist. I didn't. But I think it leavens over time. I think you have to allow yourself to be angry and sad because you've got a good reason to be, and not wallow in it, but just acknowledge that I'm having a bad day and there's nothing anybody can do to fix it. And just have a bad day. Give yourself permission. You don't have to be happy and cheery about anything.
But again, move on. Move forward.
Yeah? Well, you just have no choice.
As best you can, yeah. Cal writes, I'm looking forward to getting this book. Brian, you say it very well. We were on Walnut Grove by Coffee and San Miguel. Getting a lot of those kind of responses.
I know exactly where they are, yeah.
Let me get some more callers aboard here, and let's hear next from Jane. Jane, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, regarding that anger and sadness, 5 years ago, my sister died in a house fire in British Columbia, and I don't think that ever goes away, but what her experience was that we could tell, what was found several feet from her house, which was burned to the ground outside the next day, we found a bunch of photo albums, the albums that she had made for her three children on each of their birthdays. They were all tossed outside along with the computer and the camera, and presumably she had gone back inside to get something else when she succumbed to the smoke. And then everything was literally burned to the ground, and it was quite a surreal process to dig through all the ash. And what I keep in my home now as an altar to her, as part of an altar to her, is some of her cutlery, some forks that are all melted and molded together, along with some of the charcoal wood and other keys and things like that that keep her close and present in my life on a daily basis. I'm in therapy, and thank you for this opportunity to share that little moment of the story.
Well, thank you so much for this, for your call. I'm so sorry about the loss of your sister. Brian, you want to say something?
Yeah, first of all, I'm also sorry for the loss of your sister. But you struck many, many chords with me. Your sister tried to save exactly the same things my wife and I actually did succeed in saving. We had about 15 minutes, and we packed our baby, our children's baby photo albums. We packed our wedding pictures. We packed a few pieces of artwork that meant something to us. We grabbed a drawer of important papers, our pets, those sentimental things that really cannot be replaced. And, gosh, it's so hard. But it's interesting to me how those things that survive. You talk about cutlery. You know, before your sister's fire, the cutlery was just silverware in a drawer. And after the fire, these things that survive take on this almost, they're almost become religious icons. It might not have meant anything to you before, but now it's all you've got left of your past life. And in our case, our miracle survivor was a salt and pepper shaker set that belonged to my wife's grandparents, Art Deco, 1920s to 30s. And we found them right where our kitchen used to be, sitting side by side, upright, in the ashes, just like they'd just been gently lowered to the ground, completely unharmed. The only thing wrong with them was the corks in the bottoms had burned out. And you can bet those things are going on some kind of a shrine when we get our house set up.
She mentioned keys, too. And in your book, keys play a pretty important figure of a role, because what are these keys for now?
Yeah, there's a page in the book where I talk about looking at my key ring, and my key ring had five keys on it, and three of them didn't do anything anymore. The key for the front door, the key for the mailbox that melted, and the key for a car that got destroyed in our garage. And I could not take them off my key ring. I just couldn't do it. There's no rational reason not to take them off and put new keys on there. I couldn't do it, and I still couldn't do it. I still have that key ring in my sock drawer. And again, someday that'll go on a hook on a shrine. But I had to think about that. And, you know, I don't say so explicitly in the book, but I think the reason the keys struck me so hard is because what do keys represent? Keys are security. Keys are how you lock yourself in, lock the world out. Keys are how you keys are freedom. Keys are how you start a car and you go away. And in one night, the fire made a mockery of our security. No lock, no door could stop this fire. They made a mockery of our freedom. They destroyed our car. And I think the keys are a very powerful symbol of what we lost.
You said you were fortunate enough to be covered with insurance fairly well, although the insurance has been a nightmare for so many people and wasn't certainly easy for you and your wife. I understand that. But you had, as you said earlier, better success than many people, or more luck than many people. Anything you can say in the way of wisdom or advice on that score for people?
Well, we're still a couple hundred thousand short, but we'll figure that out.
But I'm glad you're laughing. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, Wayne. But yes, I would say know what's in your insurance policy. So many people don't. And understand what you're insured for and how much you're insured for.
Maybe video everything, too.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. Go around, yeah. Because so many insurance companies, not ours, but many insurance companies required their customers to provide a complete list of everything they owned, every single thing. How many forks did you own? How many books? How many CDs and DVDs? And how many pillows? And how many pillowcases and towels? You had to make a complete list of everything and put a dollar value on it. And which just struck me as the most cruel, ridiculous thing ever. If an insurance company has agreed to insure everything you own for X thousand dollars, and you lose everything you own, you'd think they'd write you a check for X thousand dollars. Not many of them won't.
That was a point I thought well made by you as well. Let me get another caller on here, and we go to Santa Rosa again, and we welcome Diane. Diane, hi.
Hi, my name is Diane, and we lost our house and two cars and didn't save anything because we weren't home when the fires happened. And since, you know, we think that's a positive thing and we think it's a negative thing. It depends on the day because we wish we'd have got something out of the house. But I wanted to comment to Brian that that when I saw your cartoons in the museum, I think you captured our hearts better than anybody of what it felt like and still feels like. And I really appreciate it. I took pictures of it and sent it off to a lot of people. And so I thank you for that. And what you say about the insurance has been absolutely horrible. We could have started building 6 months earlier, except we were fighting with our insurance company. And I think probably for me, you know, I'm 72 years old, so I lost so much of things that my mother had made. So when you comment about, you know, people say, you know, it's just stuff, it can be replaced, that's not really true. You know, you say it was our stuff, and that's true. But I think our grandchildren are what's helped us to make it through. We still have a long process to go, but that's what's helping us.
Well, Diane, thank you so much for telling your story, and I appreciate and hope that things will move along forward, and I appreciate hearing from you this morning. Let me read some more testimony coming in from listeners. James writes, I'm a member of Marin's search and rescue team. We were involved in searching through the burned neighborhoods in the weeks following the fires. We found a few victims. As a resident of Sebastopol myself, I witnessed the fall of ash and burned pages from people's books landing on our property here. That didn't prepare me for what I saw when we went into Coffee Park and Fountain Grove, vast swaths of destruction that didn't discriminate between rich and poor, a very important point that Brian makes in his book. And here's Joanne, who writes, we live in Deer Park, Napa Valley, and at one point we were surrounded by the fires. We had been on evacuation alert for a week. At the time, my husband was quite ill, but had been on the upswing, and the day after we were cleared to stay home, my husband had a massive heart attack and died in my arms. His heart was strong, but the smoke and stress was more than his weakened body could stand. Every time I walk into our home, I would gladly have given it up and still have my dear husband with me.
Well, I think that's a story that continues to be told and untold, is the continuing impact of these fires. I know a few people who didn't die as a result of the fires, but the fire just took so much wind out of their sails, was so exhausting, so stressful, so hard, that I know at least a couple people personally who I think died before their time. And I think that will continue to be the case. And that's not even to mention, you know, the possible pulmonary complications from breathing all that stuff from our fire and then from the campfire last year or a year later. This is a disaster that's going to echo through the Bay Area for years and maybe decades to come.
I'm afraid you are right on that, ominously. And you talk about grabbing your pets. Your cat, you feel, died because of the stress of this fire.
The cat was ill to begin with. Yeah. But yeah, the cat didn't handle the transition well. We got her out of the house right after the fire. My wife and I lived with our daughters in Novato for a month. And, you know, an old cat doesn't handle that well. An old cat doesn't like to just have its life uprooted and have to stay in a cage She went downhill pretty quickly after that.
Here's Merrily, who writes, I lost my husband suddenly 24 years ago and have been running widows and widowers grief recovery programs for about 20 years. The experience of being angry when you see everyone else having a normal life when you are totally devastated is so true. I felt that way toward couples walking down the street holding hands. My sister and her partner lost their house in Paradise and are currently nomads traveling the country trying to find the next place to live. They don't intend to rebuild because of their age. Again, all too common a story. Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Kyle. Thank you for waiting. Kyle's calling from Santa Rosa. Hi.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. Brian's wife is actually my boss's boss's boss. I'm a county social worker with Adult Protective Services, and she has actually shown his cartoon in staff meetings. I don't know if he knows that.
I do.
But what I wanted to call and say is that I've heard a lot of older adults calling in, people over 65 who are affected by these fires, and I want to remind them that the county has adult protective services that can help facilitate a lot of this recovery effort by offering counseling and referral services, and wanted to make sure that information was known.
Yeah, Kyle, thanks for bringing that up. Those services are available, and people should be aware of them, and I appreciate you bringing it to the fore here.
I would add, by and large, government services served us very well. I mean, FEMA was
FEMA comes off looking pretty good in your book.
They come off looking okay, although they did deny one of the people I interviewed services for no good reason. But particularly Sonoma County. The Sonoma County set up a local assistance center in downtown Santa Rosa. You know, if you lost your passport and your birth certificate and your Social Security card, they could basically print you up new ones as you sat there and waited. It was a really nice multi-agency effort that helped a lot of people.
As I said, a fire story is not only Brian Fee's family story, but it's also other stories that are in here. And thank you for your book, and thank you for your work, and thank you for spending this time with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Brian Fees, cartoonist, author, and the book, again, is A Fire Story. He'll be at Reader's Books in Sonoma on April 5th at 6:30, and then at Moe's Books in Berkeley on April 10th at 7 o'clock. You can meet him in either or both of those places. And thank you for joining us this opening hour of Forum. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Ariana Prell. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Our executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, stay tuned for another hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.